We're not going to have a timekeeper. That doesn't mean I can't interrupt you if you get carried away. Here, you're going to need a microphone. But do give us a short introductory opening statement, and then we'll get right down to the questions.
Sounds good. Thank you, everyone, for being here. My name is Justin Ruffridge, and it's a pleasure to be with you guys today. A little bit about me. I grew up in this area, moved up here with my family in 1994. We drove up the Alcan in a Plymouth Reliant, myself, my younger brother, and my six-month-old sister. As you can imagine, I did everything in my power to try to be the navigator on that trip. I did not want to be in the back seat, and my mother was kind enough to allow me to do that. So north to Alaska, and my parents are both educators. They came here to teach at Wings Christian Academy, a small Christian school out on K Beach Road. And they taught there for north of 20 years. And that was a school I attended. I graduated from that school in 2001, graduating class of two. So I was, I think, the worst performer and the best performer in my graduating class. Valedictorian and class clown, all of the above. I went to a couple of different schools after that. I first attended Kenai Peninsula College. I did that in my senior year as a jumpstart student, which that program is incredible. I was able to get some of my college credits out of the way before attending school for 1 year in Pensacola, Florida. And then ultimately deciding to go to Washington State University College of Pharmacy. I graduated from there in 2008 with a Doctor of Pharmacy degree and moved back to this area and worked at Soldotna Professional Pharmacy with Tom Hodell and family for a number of years until he sold that pharmacy to an outside organization. We worked for that group for a few years, and then they decided to sell, and myself and a business partner were able to acquire that store. And since then have acquired another store in Juneau and have opened a pharmacy, the only remote pharmacy in the state, in Girdwood. My family all lives here with the exception of my brother still. My wife is here today, Jessie, and she has been a great support and a wonderful person in my life. We've been married for 18 years. We have two children, ages 8 and 7. They're in third and second grade, and they like to fight one another. So we keep entertained at home. I have been on our Soldotna City Council for 4 years. I was appointed to that position after serving on Planning and Zoning Commission for about a year. I currently serve as the chairman of our State Board of Pharmacy, and I was on our board all through COVID times. So I think that was a experience that gave me insight into what it means to have thick skin. Frankly, without that experience, I'm not certain I would be doing this today. It gave me insight in what it takes to truly be in public service and how to do things at a state level. So happy to be here today and look forward to answering questions.
Thank you, Justin.
Yeah.
Now, if we didn't have ranked choice voting and it was the way the election used to be held, this would now be our representative, okay, because he would not have any opponent. They're both Republicans. Okay, so you have two Republicans in the general election, and ranked choice voting will not apply because one or the other will win. Okay, so just so that you know, you won't be ranking one or two. You'll just vote for one, and the winner will take this seat. Okay, with that, Justin, and the other thing, just kind of elaborate a little bit on how these forums have progressed over the years and evolved, is that it is unique in the fact that it's not a town hall meeting. We don't take questions from the audience. It's to prepare the questions. Everyone is welcome to submit a question, which we will then ask. After the forum, which we get out on time, the candidates will always stick around, and if you want to ask them, debate with them, you know, one-on-one, then they will be all too happy to answer your questions. So with that, Justin, our first question is, how will you stay in touch with your constituents if elected?
Well, I'm doing that work right now. That involves doing what we're doing here, being in a place where the people that I hope to represent are at. I think talking to people is imperative. I've been going door to door for 4 months now, talking with people, working on my tan. That's been a good side effect, I guess, going door to door. And I ask one question: what are the issues that are important to you? And there's a lot of consensus amongst people. It's surprising, actually, how many people agree on what they want to see done in Juneau, and some of the concerns they have. And I think that, frankly, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to go door to door. But I don't know any more efficient way of getting to know people. It's very difficult to get people to attend events even, or seminars or town halls. Oftentimes you do have to just go to where they're at, which is home, and say, what's important to you? And I've really enjoyed that process. I was initially a little nervous about what that looks like. My only other experience of going door to door was trying to sell candy bars for a Kenai Little League, and I did not like that, and I wasn't very good at it. So,
been bitten by any dogs?
I've not been bitten by any dogs, no.
Yeah, I'm sure as you've been going door to door, you've heard about fisheries. This is an issue that a lot of people are interested in here locally. It's an industry that has transitioned over the last 30, 40 years. And where do you stand on fisheries? And as the representative of this district, what do you bring forward in regarding the fishery issues?
Yeah, I've been hearing from a lot of people. There tends to be a bit of a fight going on. I'm sure you're aware of that. Sport fishing versus commercial fishing. And what's interesting, again, that process of going and talking to people and finding what people have in common, there's a lot of commonalities between the sport fishing group and the commercial fishing group. Two things that I think we can work on right away is research. That needs government funding in order to do that. Some of the things that we used to do in our in-river fishery is monitor the number of, especially king salmon, that are exiting the river. That's an extremely expensive process to do, and we've stopped doing that actually in the 80s because of the cost to do so. We have no idea how many fish, king salmon in particular, because that's the one that a lot of people are worried about, because that's what's shutting down the commercial fishery and the in-river fishery. We don't know how many are exiting. We know how many are coming up the river and spawning, but and we hope are spawning, but we would only know that by measuring how many are exiting the river. I think money for research is important, and I think we need to prioritize that. I think the second thing that it seems like is an agreement point for almost all involved in the fisheries is stopping trawler bycatch. And I think that, although a federal issue, needs to be lobbied for and levied against by state representatives.
Okay, thank you. Justin, it's been said that you support mandatory vaccines and that you would be a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical companies. Your response?
Wait, someone in this room wrote that question?
I get them anonymously.
Okay.
They pass them on to me.
Good. Yeah. So the answer to that is no. I don't support mandatory vaccines. As you're aware from my introduction, I am a healthcare provider in this area. And for many of you who don't know, I was very active throughout COVID. Our pharmacy was very active throughout COVID, opening up vaccine clinics. In partnership with the borough, we vaccinated thousands of people. Our very first priority the day that vaccines came into our area was to vaccinate the members and residents of our assisted living facilities and nursing homes who wished to be vaccinated. I personally think the job of a healthcare provider is to give information and allow people to measure risk versus benefit. The vaccine, especially when it came out initially, didn't have a lot of information available to people. And so we worked overtime, many hours, in order to develop talking points, information for people. And we're really proud of the work we were able to do initially during COVID with vaccinating our most vulnerable people. After that, we partnered with the borough, opened up large vaccination clinics all across the borough. We were in Sterling, Kasilov, Soldotna. We partnered with the Kenai Fire Department for vaccine clinics in Kenai. We went to Cooper Landing a number of times. And then after that process died down in about middle of April, early May, we opened up the only walk-in vaccine clinic that was dedicated to COVID vaccines at the Y in Soldotna, and we operated that for 1 year. All of that we did essentially because it was the right thing to do, similar to my rationale for running for office. You do things that are right for your community because they are important to have people engaged in that process. If you see something that you can help with, you do it. That's my approach to vaccines. And to give information. I will say one of the most difficult days for me as a healthcare provider was the day that vaccines were mandated by the federal government for federal employees. Many people coming to our vaccine clinic and to our pharmacy, some, you know, grown people with jobs in the federal government weeping in our offices about the decision that they had to make. That is not why I went into healthcare. And it was very difficult to see, and I think that that mandate was wrong, and I'm glad to see that that has at least been tempered, although there are still some companies that require it, and I think that that is a tough decision for a company to make, and as a healthcare provider, I always value giving people information and allowing them to make that risk versus benefit decision. Permission for one more statement on that, or do you have another question?
Oh, I got a lot of questions.
Okay. Well, we'll let it be there then.
Okay, as I said in the opening remarks, if it wasn't for ranked choice voting, you'd be now running unopposed.
Yes.
Because there were only two Republicans in the primary. So what is your opinion on ranked choice voting? And if elected, would you work to repeal it? And if so, what would you be leaning toward replacing it in the future?
Yeah, ranked choice voting is is entertaining. We're about ready to see that today. It's making national news. We're the entertainment for the world on Wednesday to find out who's going to win this U.S. House House race. That being said, I would say a lot of people, myself included, are concerned about ranked choice voting. In my opinion, I think it's good to see something work before you try to change it. But it's caused a lot of confusion. I'm worried about people's voting record not counting due to confusion over how to rank someone on a ballot. That's a concern for me. I would be in favor of putting it back on the ballot again. I'm concerned about repealing it from the legislative perspective. I think that's a bad precedent to set for a legislature to override the vote of the people, even if it is a very small margin. And I think the ballot measure I would like to see put forward is from talking to people. People in Alaska are independent people. The majority of people in this state are independent or undeclared or nonpartisan. And I think one of the things that people like about ballot measure two is the idea of an open primary, where you can just go and you have all the candidates available to you, however many there are, and you get to choose the one that most represents you. And then the top four or top two, whatever that deciding factor, gets moved forward. And then we would have a simple vote after that, one vote one. I would like to see that be on a ballot at some point so we can decide on that as a state.
Okay, going back a little bit of history, and also, you know, the people said they want a 90-day session. And then we got into special sessions. So what is your opinion on a 90-day session and the fact that we haven't seen a 90-day session since the people said we want you out of there in 90 days?
Yes, well, as I said in my introduction, I have a family here, two young kids. I have a vested interest in a 90-day session. Let's get the work done and let's go home. And I think that's what you hear from people everywhere you go. I think I would absolutely support a 90-day session, and I think it can be done. The really big pressure point on that is the budget, and the PFD consistently becomes a stagnation point. And it's used as a leverage to continue sessions, sometimes past the point where it really should be. We saw that with the multiple special sessions. Wow, that's a tough thing to say. A couple things on that. I think the PFD issue needs to be solved, and I think our budget needs to be biannual, meaning every 2 years. Our legislative session is a two-year cycle. Why would we argue about the budget twice in one session? That seems like we just enjoy arguing at that point. So if we were to solve the budget in the first 90 days and then leave the second 90 days for dealing with legislative issues, I think that might help solve that problem.
Okay, and what do you think about the executive branch employees taking loyalty oaths, and why?
Well, I think it's ridiculous, and I think it shouldn't happen. That was my short answer. Would you like a longer one?
Okay, I hardly had time to check that one off.
Oh, okay.
How will the House organize? And will you join a coalition? And if joining in the majority, what committees would you want to serve on?
Well, I think there is a lot to be said here, so maybe I can take up some of my previous questions' time with this one. What we saw in the last session was discouraging to me from the House perspective as a Republican. The Republicans had a majority in that session and chose instead to relinquish their ability to be in the majority. And I think they did that for one reason. There were Republicans within the majority that the other Republicans didn't want to work with. That is, frankly, ridiculous. I think that if you're in a majority, let's say in this case the vote holds true for what the House primary looked like and the Republicans are in the majority, I think we have an obligation to work with the people of our party, regardless of whether or not they might hold some views or are difficult to work with or whatever those things are. I think we saw from the last session, even after Republicans were in the minority, they still were kicking members out of their minority caucus. Republicans and, frankly, all politicians need to quit eating themselves and, frankly, focus on the work that needs to get done. So I would plan on being in the majority in the House. I think the other issue at hand, especially for myself as a Republican, we allow sometimes the independent personalities in the House to sway back and forth. I think Republicans have an opportunity to find an independent or two that wants to join the majority coalition and help put up our numbers into that 23, 24, 25 realm where we're not so beholden to, you know, one or two flip-flop votes. So,
okay, the other part of the question is committee assignments. Where do your interests lie? What committees would you want to be on in the organization?
Absolutely. I think everybody would assume that I would serve on Health and Social Services Committee. I think I would really value being on that committee. And I think hearing from people in this area, education is a priority, and I would hope to serve on an education committee as well.
Okay, we've been kind of addressing this one, but what do you see as common ground in the legislature for a long-term fiscal plan? And are there items that you see as non-negotiable?
Well, I think the fiscal plan is non-negotiable, just in general. I listened to a lot of legislative session last year and the year before. I think what was very interesting to me, there was a one moment in our end of this last session where a representative stood up and they were speaking on concurrence of the budget and said, I would like to talk about the fiscal plan, but I know that we're only talking about changes that are in the budget currently, so I assume the fiscal plan is off the table. And the entire House laughed. It was a joke that the fiscal plan was not on the table. And I think that that speaks sometimes to the attitude in the room of this is an impossible task, and so maybe we just leave it off the discussion point. I think there needs to be a group of people, and after this election is done, I think that's when that work starts, put together a group of people who that is their non-negotiable. We don't move on anything until we have a fiscal plan, and we solve arguing about the PFD, and we put that forward for a vote. That would be my hope, and I would hope that it would come from our majority group.
Okay, thank you, Justin. These figures are a week old, and with the volatility of the price of oil, don't quote me on any of them, but I'm going to read them the way we have them. The recent price of oil decline has eaten away $1.4 billion budget, the budget surplus that Governor Dunleavy signed into law earlier this year. Now, the PFD amount is said to be $3,200 as part of the budget process. While this number is short of the statutory PFD amount, what's your proposed solution to paying a dividend and funding necessary state services all within a balanced budget? And do we need to repeal and rewrite the statute currently in effect?
The PFD statute?
Yes.
Well,
the payout of the PFD statute.
I think there is, wow, that is a good, that's a deep question. A few things. One, I think I mentioned that earlier, I think the budget process needs to be a biannual process. Two, I think that the budget needs to be, as we saw this year, not volatile based off of a singular point in time and then a projection on the price of oil. I would be in favor of, well, actually, the Hilcorp does this with their budgeting. I was talking to some of their staff and executives a couple of weeks ago. They make their own corporate budget off of a $40 barrel of oil. So if Hilcorp is doing their work off of a $40 barrel of oil, I get that a state and a private corporation, not quite the same thing. But I think we have an obligation to set a floor for our budget and work within our means. That's what I hear from people. That's my own personal opinion as well. What is the average price of oil over the last 20 years? I think, you know, if you do just simple, you know, head calculation, it's probably $60 a barrel. And then we just made a budget for, you know, the price of oil to be above $100 a barrel. And if it drops below, I think, $94, we're struggling to pay our bills. People are really sick of that, very sick of that. And I think one of the things that has to be answered is that PFD statute that we're talking about. We're following a statute. It's up to the legislature which one of the moment they're choosing to follow. I hear from people consistently over and over and over again, follow the law or change the law. Either have the fortitude to get in to do the work and say, hey, there might be some changes that are needed here, and put that forward for a vote, and quit playing games with the PFD. And really, from what I hear, people would rather choose a change to the PFD than an income tax or any other type of tax. So that would be the place we'd need to look first.
The LNG project has occupied a lot of time, both of our representatives in the legislature, both in the public, both in the free enterprise section. Once again, we hear whisperings, we hear good news, but we've heard good news, as Kurt would attest to, for decades now about the AK LNG project. And what should the state, or what could the state do to really help move this project forward and start burning some welding rods?
Well, one of the first things we need to do is have a workforce that's capable of working on this project. I think that is a key component to building anything in this state. We did a very good job back in the early days of this state building a pipeline originally, and so many people I meet, especially in the healthcare field, are the old timers that were here early, and it was because they had the skills necessary and it was a good living. I'm concerned that right now in this state, especially after talking to a number of business owners, people in the oil industry now, our workforce development is a concern, particularly with the fact that we have infrastructure dollars coming into the state and every other state of the union. So when we are going out to compete for jobs, would you rather work building a pipeline in Alaska or work on infrastructure in Hawaii? I don't know. I think we're going to struggle to find some people that want to work in Alaska. So workforce development and developing our Alaskan workforce is going to be imperative to bringing any project to fruition.
Okay, let me follow up on that a little bit. I mean, even radio stations locally have imported talent from Florida and out of state to fill job positions. So workforce development, while is important when they're talking about thousands of jobs, of skilled jobs that will be necessary for this project. We've had a governor who made it his top priority in office, and it looked like he was actually going to propose that the state build the pipeline. So give me your opinion on that versus getting the private sector and incentivizing the private sector with the world conditions as they are now to go ahead and monetize this project.
Yeah, I think, honestly, if we want the private sector to build it, and I'm not opposed to the private sector building it, I think the state probably has a better chance at getting it done. Frankly, from the perspective of the state hasn't been exactly clear on whether or not we want private companies, particularly in the oil and gas sector, to do work in this state. We've flip-flopped back and forth on tax structure. We have consistently, on almost every ballot for the last 6 to 8 years, put forward some change to the tax structure on oil and gas companies in the state. Oil and gas corporations are already trying to decide in this movement towards green energy whether or not Alaska is a viable proposition for them to be in. So I think on that level, maybe the state has a better chance at bringing it to bear. But that being said, I think there's opportunity for this state to set a foundation that we are a resource state and we want these developers to be here. And to do so, we need to be able to set something that's firm in the legislature and hold to it and not continue to bring these forward on ballot measures.
So you would support a state-owned pipeline?
I think if that's the way that the pipeline can be built, because I think it needs to be built, I would be in favor of that.
Okay, and if elected, would you prioritize the reopening of the local Kenai office of for child care assistance?
Oh, absolutely. I don't have anything to add to that, 100%.
Okay, moving right along, your position on calling a state constitutional convention, which comes in at an estimated price tag of $17 to $20 million.
Yeah, that's interesting. Point of contention, especially amongst people in the conservative camp, which I would consider myself to be in, especially from a fiscal perspective, I think calling a constitutional convention is interesting that many conservatives are calling for the constitutional convention. I myself am pretty firmly going to be a no vote on a constitutional convention for one reason, and it actually doesn't have to do with the fiscal note attached to that. It has to do with the fact that we haven't set process for how delegates will be called, who can be a delegate, how that process will move forward for meetings, where people will meet. And I think for myself, I would love that question to be answered before I'm asked to call a constitutional convention. If we had a very clear method by which the convention would be called, who could be a delegate, and how that process were to move forward, I would maybe have a little bit of a more difficult time answering that question. But as of right now, I think it would cause more problems than it would solve.
Okay, in a time of extreme polarization on issues that affect family, friends, and the business community, what can be done to find consensus and to moderate the divide in state politics?
Well, yeah, I have been in the spotlight, in the hot seat, I guess, on some politicization or polarization of some issues since the day I sat on city council. We've had some hot button topics come forward, and I think especially this process of going door to door has proved to be an invaluable opportunity, because you find that there is a huge amount of common ground amongst people. I think the abortion topic, and I don't know if you have questions about that upcoming, but I'll cut right in front of the line, is a great way to highlight that. Whether you fall into the pro-life or pro-choice camp, one of the questions that I ask people diligently at every stop where abortion rights or the right to choose or right to life or any of these topics come up, I ask one question. I say, would you agree that a good goal for the state of Alaska is to reduce the number of abortions that are performed in this state? And the answer to that, inevitably, from 99.8% of people is absolutely. I think that is a good goal. And so that sets a foundation. That sets a floor for having conversations with people. Okay, great. Well, what are some things, what are some ways that, since we all agree that this is the goal that we have, what are some ways that we can do this? That's been a very large priority in my life and in my wife and I's life together. We've been active in the in the relationships that are necessary to put that reducing abortion topic forefront in our life. And I think that's what it takes. I think it takes relationship building. I think it takes being in places where people are at, like this forum, being here, doing the work, going door to door, finding out what people say, getting to know the people that you're working with in the legislature, regardless of whether they're annoying or they stabbed you in the back the last time. And I think that there is a precedent for myself in my 4 years in public service that I work really well with others because I can see the humanity behind people. Everyone has a story. They have a reason for why they believe the way they believe. And if we can get to the heart of the matter, there's a lot of work that can be done there.
Okay, you went to one of the questions a little bit ahead of time, but because of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, it comes back now to the state.
Yeah.
So your position on the state of Alaska, and maybe in more detail what you were talking about just theoretically or philosophically, should the state change its abortion policies and of state funding abortions in the future?
Well, if it were up to me, I think we should listen to people. And the goal that I hear is let's reduce abortions to zero. And then I hear a lot of different solutions to that from a lot of different people. The problem with that is that it takes funding to do a lot of these things. So it takes funding to operate pregnancy care centers. It takes funding to offer contraception options. It takes funding to offer counseling. It takes funding to offer people housing. A great statistic, actually, that is pretty prominent and has really affected how I think about things from this perspective is that a large number of women who are seeking abortion in this state are women who have children that they're parenting already. This speaks to an economic situation. It speaks to a decision that women are being faced with that is gut-wrenching, difficult. How do I support how do I support this child? How do I support more children? We have poverty in this state. We have hungry people. We have children, many children in foster care. Our OCS system struggles to keep people hired. We struggle to keep social workers. We struggle to take care of the kids that we have that are struggling to find homes or placements. There is so much work to be done from a state perspective at prioritizing life. And I think that it comes down ultimately to a budget decision. Do we prioritize it? Do we prioritize in taking care of women and children when they have a crisis? And I think the answer to that right now in this state is sometimes, and we can do better at that.
So specifically, would you introduce or support legislation to change Alaska's abortion laws?
Well, I think that the abortion laws as they sit are pretty free. We have one of the, I think, most significant access to abortion in the United States. I think the pro-life question, which is I would say myself as a pro-life person, has less to do with changing law about abortion in particular, and more about changing our attitude about life and prioritizing life in the state. And I say that for one reason, because I saw, especially from the healthcare perspective, how difficult it is, because you'll hear lots of people saying we need to ban abortion. I see how difficult it is, and look at history, to ban things in this country. We didn't do a great job at banning alcohol during Prohibition. What that led to was a black market for alcohol. Do we want to create a black market for abortion? Do we want to create, I'm a healthcare provider. I know that, you know, the majority of abortions in this state are performed chemically. And I know this is a difficult subject, but I think it's an important subject. It's four tablets. That's what it takes. We saw through COVID many, many people wanting to get access to ivermectin and struggling because many corporations decided that they weren't going to dispense it at all and they wanted to take it or their doctor prescribed it. Where did they get it from? They got it through the mail, from India, from Mexico, from Bangladesh, you name it, they got it through the mail. Is that what we want to create by banning abortion in this state? I don't. And I think when we put it that way, we really drive the question home of, are we trying to make a political point Or are we actually trying to value life, women's lives, children's lives? What is our priority? And that's really where I come from personally. And I think that has merit based off of conversations I have with many people that feel the same.
Okay, thank you. Your opponent in his remarks here put a priority on education. So we ask, is the current education funding formula too low, too high, or just right?
I think we can do better in one specific area. I put this on my website, voteruffrage.com, for those of you who... And there's pamphlets on the table if you'd like to take one of those home with you, because Ruffrage is sometimes hard to spell, believe it or not. Not exactly an ideal name like, whose sign? Tyson? Tyson, are you here? Yeah, Cox for Assembly.
Back to the funding formula.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Like, what? How do you get a name like that? I know. All right. Anyway, I think the funding for our schools in this area right now is doing okay. One of the areas that is not doing well is teacher retention. I think that needs to be a priority here. And one of the reasons we don't have great teacher retention is our retirement system got changed to a defined contribution plan, which in and of itself is a good start. But we have people that come here, start their career here, and then leave. Growing up here, and I think there's a couple of people in this room right now, people who made it their career to be an involved teacher or administrator in the school district. And now they've retired, but they've stayed here. And they've become a valuable asset. They're the people running our elections. They're the people running our library volunteer programs. They're the people that are helping out with school volunteer opportunities. And some of them are coming back as substitute teachers. There is a huge amount of importance based on keeping teachers in this state. I think we need to fix our teacher retirement system. We had the political willpower to change that for firefighters and police officers. So I think the political willpower should be there to also address that situation for teachers in this state. And I think that would be the first priority to adjust as far as funding goes. And it would take an increase in funding to do that.
So I would interpret that it's just right.
It's okay for our system, just right for our system. It's too low for our retirees.
Okay, what about your opinion on cash-based forward funding of education?
Well, if we had cash.
$83 billion doesn't mean cash, right?
Right. If we had cash, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I think we saw the legislature thought that was a good idea too, but then didn't have the cash to do it. And bravo to Governor Dunleavy for calling the bluff on that and saying, I think that's not a great plan to fund something without the cash in hand, and it goes against our laws. I do like it when legislatures follow laws. We've struggled with that a bit in past memory, but I think that there is an opportunity there to put some cash into forward funding, and I've had a great opportunity to do so with a lot of cash coming into the state with oil revenues the way they were, but
Okay, in a state with less than $750,000 population,
yes.
People, okay. Should we have three major state university campuses? Again, are we spending too much, too little, or just right?
Well, as a previous student of the university system, and I was an adjunct professor at one point for UAA, I would say having a university system in our state is very important. I think one of the things we could prioritize is having more professional degree programs that are offered at UAA. I think there's an opportunity there to consolidate some of our university systems, similar to some of our school districts, and potentially have some savings. But we operate in a gigantic state. And I want to be clear, when people try to make comparisons to how other state universities are run or other state programs or education systems, it's very difficult to compare those to Alaska. We are very different. And we pay a lot more for a lot of things. And luckily we have a wealth fund to help with some of those issues, but we have to realize we are different. And so, is it gonna cost a lot more to have, If you wanted to, I went to Washington State University. If you wanted to drive to the other state universities, you could get there in an hour and a half. From Washington State University to UW is only 4 hours. For our state, if you want to get from UAA to UAF, I mean, what is that, an 8-hour drive? If you want to get to UAS, that's an airplane or a boat ride. I mean, we're different. And so we do need to prioritize the fact that we are different, and it may just cost more to operate universities in our state. But I think that there's an opportunity to look for consolidation efforts.
We're almost there, Justin, just a couple more. Any ideas on how senior citizens with fixed incomes handle inflation and the high medical costs that we are seeing at the moment?
You saved that question for last? It's like a 20-minute answer.
I have another.
Oh, Merrill. Well, that's my wheelhouse. I have actually offered in one of my first opportunities to be involved in state legislative issues was to bring forth legislation on this exact topic. This is very important to me. I deal with this day in and day out, people having to make choices about whether or not they can afford their medication or whether they need to change to something different. One of the biggest issues in this is the insurance industry. I brought forward at least two pieces of legislation now that have both passed with great bipartisan support. House Bill 240, one session ago, and House Bill 145 were healthcare related. And they have to do with healthcare pricing. And they have to do with a certain middle group called a benefit manager that sits in the middle of everything to do with insurance and what things cost. They have a nefarious practice called spread pricing, where they will tell, for example, the state of Alaska, who is a large insurer of people, they'll tell the state it's going to cost you $500 million to insure your people this year. In reality, it's actually only going to cost $200 million to insure those people. But, you know, they have come in as the lowest bid, and they pay out the benefits, and they know that if we only pay out $200 million, but charge the state $500 million, we made $300 million off the state of Alaska. And nothing about this process is transparent. If you want to ask Optum, who runs the state of Alaska insurance program, to see what their pricing and their payouts look like, they will tell you to go fly a kite. It is, so what other states have done, Ohio being the prime example, they've audited them. They've come after them hard. State of Ohio is saving $231 million a year on their benefits because they found out that spread pricing was occurring at that level in their state and said, no, we're not doing that anymore. And they held their feet to the fire. But you have to be able to speak that language. You have to know what's happening behind the scenes. And healthcare is... And we know it. We know it when we go to the doctor. We know it when we go to the pharmacy. This shouldn't be happening.
We're going to squeak in one more. There are a couple here that you would probably have found embarrassing, but we'll just allege to the fact that people were asking about the two awards that you have won and also being the Chamber's Person of the Year, but you can just blush in front of everybody. You won't take that. I'd rather have you address real quickly the bond propositions in the borough in the October elections and state reimbursement on a capital budget for deferred maintenance.
Yeah, well, I think the bond propositions are important. I think you see the price of money right now is maybe the biggest concern there for me. The longer you defer, the more expensive it gets. And I think the state has an obligation to help fund some of our maintenance. I think the borough and the state have worked well together on that in the past. The truth is we just got ourselves into a hole where we didn't have any money, and we didn't budget appropriately, and then we took money out of our budget reserve, and now we're going to have to work ourselves out of that hole. Who here has been here longer than 10 years in this state? Yeah. You guys remember the good days, right? Yeah. Those were the days. There was just money, and we could do things. I think most of us remember the good days, and I think we know what that feels like, and we have to work really diligently to get back to a place where we don't have to fight over these issues anymore, but it's important.
Thank you, Justin. Give me 60-second wrap-up, and then we'll turn it back to Brent for our announcements.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Merrill, for not having me sing here today. I really thought that was going to be...
It was on the list.
Good thing I talked long enough to avoid singing. Thank you guys for being here today. Hopefully you heard some answers to some of your questions. If not, you can go to my website, Vote and Ruffridge, which is RuffRidge.com. And I have a lot of things on that website that I've taken a lot of time to write about from talking to people. I have a tab on there called Priorities According to You, and that comes just from going door to door, talking with people, talking about what's important. And I really, really, really invest myself in that process. And so I hope you find that to be as important as I do, being able to learn what priorities are to your neighbors and your friends. And that's what I think the job of a representative is. It's to be here. It's to be here, and it's to do the work. It's to sit in front of you. It's to answer your questions. It's to look you in the face and say, this is who I am. This is who you are. Thank you for the opportunity to represent you. And I think this is not a solo job. This is a job where it's going to require expertise from you who have done work that I have never done. And what is important to you, and how can I represent that in our state legislature? And I certainly would value your vote and being able to talk to me, even if you don't vote for me, because that would be the job that I am signing up to do. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
We thank you for being here, and as always, we applaud the system and the sacrifices of the men, women, and families who allow us to have a government elected by the people. Let's applaud all of those people. And a big thank you to our candidate.